Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
You really turn me on. Well, I'm
all right, it's Dave Player back with you here on 720 WGN. So Jimmy Angel isn't your average entertainer. While his last name is Angel, the man's been through hell, having a once promising rock career as a major teen idol on the heels of Elvis himself. In a life-or-death scenario, Angel, who had 38 singles on top U.S. labels under his belt before being whisked off to Japan over 30 years ago, thanks to the goodwill and open checkbooks of several major players in the Nashville music trade. He spent the next three decades overseas touting his authentic American rock persona, but yearning to return his rock roots back to America. He's back, and with a story about music and the mob, he's got a new album out as well, and an interesting life story to share. It's Jimmy Angel. Jimmy, welcome in.
Thank you, sir.
So how did your story, Jimmy, in rock and roll begin? You grew up in Memphis.
Yes, sir. Fort Lauderdale Project.
And tell me a little bit about how music kind of started in your life.
Well, all I did in high school was chase chicks and play baseball. And I played 3 years of minor league ball for the Yankee system. And then I got hurt. So I went back, they sent me back to Memphis. And my mom looked in the newspaper trying to find me a job to survive. And there was no jobs for a cat who can't read or write. Anyway, I'd go to this record store. It's called Popular Music. Joe Coogie was the owner. That's where Johnny Cash, Roy Orbison, Charlie Rich, Rufus Thomas, Jerry Lee, Elvis. Rufus Thomas used to do his radio show from there. Anyway, I go there. There was a girl from our high school, Bonnie Minnell. So I'm there in the record store on Sunday, and Joe Coogie came up to me. Hey, Jimmy, I got four cats from New York. They want to talk to you. So here comes these four guys. One was Ted Simonetti. He used his name, Ted Eddie. He was managing Louis Prima and Keeley Smith and Tony Bennett at the time. And Hugo Luigi Creatore, who wrote In the Jungle, and then Can't Help Finding Love for Elvis. And then Fred Fiola, who was Joe Colombo's cousin. And they came up to me and just said, hey, kid, you look like Elvis and Ricky Nelson. You want to be a singer? And I said, I can't sing. He says, we didn't ask you that. We own 10 record companies. We can make you sound any way we want. And then they said the magic word, sir. We hear you need a job to help your mom. And I said, yes, sir. What do I got to do? You just do what you're told. We'll take care of the rest. And they gave my mom and altogether $5,000 out of their pocket. And my mom put me in the kitchen of our little apartment. These boys look like Al Capone boys. And I said, hey, Mom, who's kidding who? I need a job to get you out of here. So they took me to New York that morning.
Wow.
And then they had me sing along with Elvis Presley Records, Buddy Holly Records.
So they were training you?
Yes, sir. For about 4 months, 5 months. And then I did a single, Teenager in Love. Doc Pomus brought the song to Lori Records. And Gene Swartz and Bob Swartz were running the label then. And so they had me do it. They released it in the southern states. And then Jan, about a year later, year and a half later, he did it and went all over the world,
Yeah, I was going to say, people don't really understand that the mob was quite intertwined with the music business back in the late 1950s and 1960s. I mean, they ran a lot of record labels.
My father owned 10. Yeah.
Well,
And then and the promotion end, I had a guy called, they called him, Don, his name was Don Terranova. They called him Wassel. And I'm not, I'm sure Dick Biondi and all those guys in Chicago remember this guy very well. Sam Giacconi.
Oh, yeah.
They, they would visit the radio stations and make an appointment with the program director or the disc jockey, the head disc jockeys, and they'd find out what was their weakness. They'd hit them with their weakness, and the records got played. You know, that's the way it worked.
That's the way it worked back then. Tell us about performing and cutting records. I mean, this was the greatest era of rock and roll when you entered. I mean, this is, you talked about 1957, 1958. I mean, what was it like, you know, being on stage and cutting records?
Well, in New York, I hung out at the Braille Building. Otis Blackwell became one of my best friends. He wrote Don't Be Cruel, All Shook Up, Return to Sender, Great Balls of Fire for Jerry Lee. He had a Cadillac with a gold license plate that said, thanks, Elvis. And we used to go to Jack Dempsey's restaurant, the bottom of the place, the Columbos, the Gambinos, we all hang out there every night, have dinner half the time. And then in the studio, in Nashville, I had Owen Bradley, Harold Bradley, the Jordanaires, DJ Fontana, Floyd Kramer on piano, Boots Randolph on sax, all those guys. And in New York, they had all studio musicians. In the West Coast, at Gold Star, they had to call the crew, you know, Glenn Campbell, Plaz Johnson.
Wow.
And all those guys. And then I just did what I was told. And Papa Joe didn't believe, and they didn't believe, releasing albums. They'd release a single, a 45. Then I was on a tour, an Alan Freed tour. My first tours were Sam Cooke, Ed James, Little Richard, Jerry Lee.
Wow.
Sam Cooke was great.
Wow.
That guy could sing so smooth. And that's the way it was. And I worked. I got $500 a week, no matter if I sold one record or a million.
Gotcha.
And,
gotcha. That was the arrangement. Did you end up performing? Now, you were performing on stage in front of live audiences and so forth in studio, but did you end up performing at all for some of the mob figures that you mentioned? I'm assuming when you went to dinner and stuff, there was some times that you entertained as well?
Oh, yes, sir. I sang for the Kennedys, Jack and Bobby. I sang for Jimmy Hoffa three times. I sang for the Gambinos, you know, the Columbos, Joe Bonanos, those, all those guys, and my Uncle Jimmy Knapp. He was the king of the numbers in New York, of the Genovese family, and they looked after me for 18 years of my life, sir. One said no to me. No one said no to me for food, tits, Broadway plays, movies, out clothes. They wouldn't take a dime from me. I tried to pay respect and pay back some of these people. They wouldn't take a quarter from me.
Elvis and Marilyn were the king and queen. Who could forget that rebel James Dean? Oh, how I would.
Because the music ties to the mob, you were a person of interest for many years with the FBI, and it was getting to be pretty overwhelming.
Well, my father, you know, Joe Colombo, he made me the poster boy for the Italian American Civil Rights League, and they had NBC do a special on me in 1970 because my father, he saved Johnny Carson's, I should say, push his life. He got in some trouble at Julie's, and some guys from the Gambinos were really gonna whack him. And my father went to NBC and said, I can fix this. Here's what I want. I want you to do a special on my singer, Jimmy Angel, and a story about the Time Red Civil Rights League. His lawyer, Johnny Carson's lawyer, released a book on that subject.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and then I was on NBC for an hour, and then we did the Madison Square Garden. And then my whole life changed. June 28, 1971, at Columbus Circle. It was about maybe, I'm not exaggerating, maybe 200 to 300,000 people. The FBI just standing around watching everything. And I just got through rehearsing with Sammy Davis Jr. in the orchestra. And I went over to Pop. And he says, yeah, it's going to be a beautiful day, Jimmy. Just get a slice of pizza before the show starts. And then this kid walks up. He had a press pass on the Daily News. His name was Jerome Johnson. And he said, Mr. Colombo, can I take a picture of you for the Daily News? And he says, yeah. Pop turned around, you know, handing his Coke. And the guy put three bullets in the back of his head. He fell on my lap. All hell broke loose. And Jerome Johnson was gone within seconds. And the FBI, they didn't do nothing. They just stood around. Then all hell broke loose. And at the moment, my life changed forever. It's like you, Mr. Pliers. You're Dave Plier. And all of a sudden, something happens. And everybody, your world, it's gone. I mean, it's like not slowly, but instantly, like a coin flip, like the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
And there I was.
Yeah. After doing this and being in this business for as long as you have and working with the people that you did, but you had some good friends that kind of got you out of there a little bit, and you went overseas and created a career for yourself there.
Yes, sir. My Uncle Jimmy Knapp gave me $1,000, put me on a bus to Nashville in 1981. And Mary Reese, God love her, Jim Reese's widow,
mm-hmm.
She met me at the bus station, took me to the Jim Reese Museum, which was like Graceland on Gallatin Road and Bradley Parkway in Nashville. And 2 hours later, here comes the feds knocking on her door. And Mary says, hello, boys. And they says, do you know what you have here? You have a mafioso. You got a Colombo. And she says, well, I know all that. I talked to New York. He's mine. You going to arrest him? No. We just want to let you know who you got. She says, we're fine. Me and the Bradleys are going to start recording some new songs and anything else. And she shut the door in their face. Hmm. She became my idol.
Yeah, she protected you. Absolutely protected you. But when you went off to Japan and really spent decades there, I mean, you really created a whole new phenomenon for yourself out there in the entertainment industry.
Well, Mr. Plyer, I've been in over 35,000 teen and movie magazines since 1957. Every magazine you could think of. And when Pat Boone came to Nashville to get me in 85, and he told me, you know why I'm signing you, Jimmy? God loves you. You're still alive. And he says, I'm going to get you out of this mess. We'll take you, send you to Japan. And I told him, I can't speak Japanese. He says, you don't have to. You look like Elvis. You got 10 gold records. And you played baseball. You're going to love you. So I went there to the Vogue Fashion Models in the first 2 weeks at the Latin Quarter, the biggest nightclub in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Pat played there, Paul Anka, Barbara Streisand, Tom Jones. And I went there, and I was there 2 weeks singing two songs a night for this fashion show, the Vogue Fashion Models. Then one night, the Filipino singer of the orchestra got sick, and Yamamoto, the owner, Jimmy-chan, can you try to sing with orchestra tonight? Our singer's sick. I walked on, after a half-hour rehearsal, I walked on stage, went, well, slid across the stage on one leg. They went nuts. And then I made $3,000 in tips.
Wow.
10,000 yen in 30 minutes. And then Yamamoto, goodbye Filipino singer, hello Jimmy. And then I did four shows a night. Then in the morning, they take me to a club early in the morning for lonely wives looking for pretty boys. Another club called First Kiss in the Morning. Then I do four more shows from 4 o'clock in the morning to 7 in the morning. That was every night.
Wow.
And then the newspaper showed up, did a story on me. Then the Japanese mafia, Yamaguchi Gumi, Papa, that's the number one family in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
They run the music business, the booze, the tobacco, the lady boys, the girly bands, the boys bands, whatever, just like New York. And they took over looking after me, and the hostess girls got me all kinds of work at the hostess clubs. And then 10 years, I was at Disneyland singing at Mickey's house. That's why I wrote American Girl for Minnie Mouse. Anyway, and then they got me Tokyo Dome. I saw Tokyo Dome 6 times. That's 56,900.
Wow. Wow.
And, yeah.
I mean, this was a whole second life for you. I mean, I know now you're not in America anymore. You're overseas. You're really not with people you know. But it really did change your life in a whole different way. And you spent, how long did you spend out there, Jimmy?
30 years.
30 years. And what brought you back to the States?
The biggest earthquake in the Tsunami in the history of Asia, a 9.5 earthquake, and the tidal waves that flattened Japan in 2010. And then everything was done. I stayed. My apartment was gone. The only thing I saved was my portfolio with all my magazines in it. And I had the 45s because I was going to do a picture layout and a tour for Coca-Cola in Tokyo when the earthquake hit, 11 o'clock.
Wow.
And then everything was done. I mean, hotels, businesses, people lost their lives. I helped the Tokyo Giants and the Cebu Lions. And all looked for dead bodies for about 2 weeks. Then I stayed at Tokyo Dome for almost 3 weeks in a tent with 100,000 people, lost everything. When I came back, I was invited to a songwriters night for BMI in West Hollywood. And I went. And one of the guys was Pete Latta. He used to play with Richie Valens. I did my first TV show with Richie Valens. And he brought these guys, Sal Gutierrez and his son, Jason Gutierrez. And they saw me sing some of my hits at the songwriter scene, telling how you make hits, write songs. And then
that's pretty cool.
They asked if they could back me up. And I said, yeah, I need a band. So that was the start. Then a little wise guy called Georgie Grossman, God love him, his grandfather was partners with Benjamin Siegel, Lovesy, for the Flamingo. He did the food service,
mm-hmm.
And this guy knew who I was, and he walked into the smokehouse, the biggest club right across the street from Warner Brothers. Didn't ask him. He told him, I want this kid to start this weekend. And I've been there ever since 2011, and I got voted as number one lounge act in L.A. by all the papers, and I'm still there.
That's amazing. And I mean, at 85 years old, okay, so now you've got a new CD and book talking about these life stories. It's got 14 original songs on it. It's available right now. You can go lovefeverthealbum.com or jimmyangel.net just to find out some more information. But tell us a little bit about the book and the CD, Jimmy.
All right. The CD, I wrote the songs the way I see it. Ricky Nelson had James Burton. Elvis had Scotty Moore, then he had James Burton, and the Booker T and the MGs backed me up for a couple of years, Steve Cropper and all those guys, and Otis Redding was one of my best friends, the greatest rhythm and blues singer I ever saw in my life. And then that's what Jason Gutierrez is to me. He's my James Burton. He arranged my songs, and with his father, Sal Gutierrez, and John T. Biggs, a great drummer. And Jason has a studio. It's almost like Sun Records, but it's got all this new equipment in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he produced the album. And it was like teamwork. That's why I'm splitting, you know, the writing on the album, sharing with my band, because they deserve it. The one thing you learn, sir, takes teamwork. It's like a shortstop and a second baseman. The second baseman has to know the shortstop. The shortstop has to know the second baseman to make double plays. Same thing on stage.
Yeah.
Your band has to be, everybody on stage is as important as the singer, whoever's the lead singer, whatever. Everybody's just important. And that's how it works.
That's how it works. Well, Jimmy's new album, again, is available. It's a newly minted CD book combo featuring 14 original songs. Love Fever, the album. You want to go to lovefeverthealbum.com, and it's also available on iTunes, Amazon Music, Spotify, and most other music services as well.
I want to thank you. If you see Dick Biondi, tell him I said hi.
Will do, buddy. Thanks again.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right, take care. All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.